On the 17th of July, I took part in a panel featuring Neil Collins, the author of International Velvet, and chaired by Gordon Anderson at Cardiff Library and Hub. Listen to what I captured on my phone from the event.
Although like there's been books obviously about the Manics and Catatonia, Stereophonic Super Furries individually, there's never been one that's, you know, got that whole era together, because it's not just the music, it's culture, it's politics, it's language, you know, a complete shift in confidence of the nation across 10 years. So it felt like a perfect time, you know, 25 years on, to have that lens of hindsight, you know, what's progressed, what hasn't, and all that sort of thing. Just to give you a little bit of an explanation of the title, really. So I was originally going to call it A Design for Life, after the Manic song, obviously. But I thought, when I had a chance to find International Velvet, I thought that spoke so much more about that shift in confidence in Wales. So for instance, you know, back in the 80s, you'd have the nation being pretty much laughed at by the London music press, or just ignored altogether. A few short years later then, whether it's ironic or not, it misses the point. You've got a singer singing Every Day When I Wake Up, I Thank the Lord I'm Welsh, from International Velvet. So it's more about the song than the album, you know, the chart-topping album. So also I like the idea that it kind of promotes internationalism, but also that Wales was exporting this great music to the world and finally getting its sort of due recognition. So I'd love to say I went to all these gigs, but I was born in 1986, so that bloody one there, I had only just finished eating rusks around then. So it's a mix of like the obscure and the iconic. So you've got like Catatonia at Markham Park, you've got Stereophonics at Cardiff Castle. But then you've got the overseas gigs like Super Furries in Japan, Dial Buds in Hollywood, the Manics in New York. So it's that real mishmash of kind of like the obscure and the iconic that I quite liked. As I said, like with the International Velvet as well, it's the change in terms of the music. So you've got like the big four, so to speak, of the Manics and Super Furries, Stereophonics and Catatonia, but you've also got the likes of, you know, the old guard meeting the young guard, in terms of Tom Jones there coming back to the number one with Reload, the biggest seller of his career at the time as well, 6 million copies. You've also got, you know, kind of relatively unheralded bands like the 60 Foot Dolls, who were, I think, kind of underappreciated really in that whole sort of Newport, New Seattle scene. I thought it was high time that whole era got celebrated, really.
Yeah, and it is a lot to cover. It's a tremendous amount to cover. And you said that whilst you didn't write it chronologically, it is a sort of very broadly chronological sort of run through it in terms of the structure of the finished item.
So yeah, I wrote the book entirely non-chronologically, which I don't think any writing tutor would ever sort of recommend, really. So I wrote it purely based on what band was interested me that day. And instead of thinking it was a 90,000 word project, which is very daunting while you're working full time as well, I thought of it as, right, I'm going to write a little essay on a band today. So it would be like 1,500, 2,000 words, stuff like that. And it's a lot easier to cope with in your head in that respect. So I'd have all the research set out on my hard drive with quotes, and it would be like thematically, like views on nationalism, views on the assembly, views on other bands, because there was quite a sort of argument that developed from Stereophonics and Manics, which I'd forgotten about. So you've got I think it started with like the Manics saying about them like trying to smash their instruments up and stuff like that, Stereophonics, and saying what a job they'd done of it. But there was also I stumbled across a documentary where Kelly had slagged them off for not getting enough time with setting up their equipment when the Stereophonics were supporting them. And I've also found quotes on Kelly Jones slagging off the Holy Bible as well, which is quite funny. It was absolute labour of love, really, researching it all, you know. But also, like, I think it's, you know, you're writers yourselves, guys. It's something you love and hate. in equal measure a lot of the time, you know, and you've got like that voice in your head saying this is crap, you know, and this is rambling, no one's going to be interested in this. So yeah, thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Excellent. Well, we should talk a little bit about, because it's impossible to, as the book talks about in detail, it's impossible to talk about what happened in the 90s without going back a little bit into the roots of some of the scenes and how this all happened. And it looks like that via through the sort of mid-1980s, and particularly via the Welsh language bands like Datblygu and Birkirk. And they were all working within a very kind of, inspired essentially a little bit down the line from punk, in a very kind of DIY kind of working environment. We're doing this on our own. What did you find interesting about that period? Obviously there's a lot happening, there was, in terms of bands, there's even some shared band members, and that continued down the years into the 90s as well, between a lot of these bands. So, what did you find interesting there?
Yeah, well, I think at any time when there's a period of real frustration and sort of anger, so to speak, really, you get great art out of that. So you think of like the amount of great music that came out of Thatcherism, really, in spite of Thatcherism. So Wales went through quite a tough time before the 90s boom. So if you go back as far as, say, 1962, you've got Saunders Lewis, the Welsh politician and academic, with his Tangi Di Iaith, The Fate of the Language speech, which was broadcast on BBC Radio, which spoke of the very real threat of Cymraeg dying out as a language. Then 3 years later, you've got Tryweryn, which is the flooding of the village in North Wales to supply Liverpool with water. Cymdeithas y Iaith Cymraeg was set up as a direct action group after that. Going forward then, you've got the resounding no to devolution in 1979. So only one in four Welshmen, or Welsh women, I should say, is voted yes for devolution in 1979. So quite a resounding no. The following decade then, you've got the decimation of the mining industry and the steelworks industry, closures all across the country, massive unemployment. So yeah, coming into the 90s, you've got a nation that's quite sort of, you know, on its arse, really. You know, you've got the culture being ignored by politicians and the media alike. So it was only, it took like hunger strikes for S4C to like be set up, you know, because Thatcher's government did a U-turn on it. So going to the start of the 90s, there's in the introduction you'll read that there was horror stories of bands actually going over to Bristol to get an English postmark on their records, so they wouldn't be tossed aside quite so quickly.
And Liverpool as well.
Yeah, Liverpool, yeah. And you have, I spoke to Gorwell Owen, who's the producer for the Super Furry Animals, amongst a lot of other things, and he was saying that he worked with a lot of bands in North Wales who played on the idea they were from Liverpool just to get more coverage, you know. Greg Haver, Manic's producer, said, you know, if you saw an A&R man this side of the Severn Bridge in the early 90s in Cardiff, you truck the bunt in because it was that like rare a sight, you know. So yeah, it really is like a seismic shift in confidence in a very short space of time. So you've got these huge influx of bands who were all like getting hugely popular, you know, number one albums in the case of the Manix and Catatonium, Stereophonics. Huge sort of cult bands, like the Super Furry Animals, I think, are one of the best bands, really, of the last 25, 30 years across the UK as well, I'd say. So yeah, on top of that, you've got the rising Welsh culture. You've got like stars like Rhys Ifans and Catherine Zeta-Jones becoming sort of household names on their way to sort of Hollywood stardom. You've got the rise in Welsh sports. You've got like the likes of Colin Jackson, Joe Calzaghe in a 46-0 career, you know, undefeated career, which you can't underestimate how good that is. You've got the iconic try from Scott Gibbs against England in 1999. You've got, you know, world-class players in the Welsh football team, although it wasn't such a successful year back then. You had like Ian Rush and Mark Hughes, the late great Gary Speed. So yeah, and on top of that as well, you've got the politics with the 1997 devolution, with the Assembly finally being created on the Bay. And you've got the rise of the Welsh language. So the Welsh Language Act of 1993 put Cymraeg and Saesneg on a lot more than even footing in day-to-day lives. So you'd see it in like public buildings, on traffic signs. Daily education changed in Wales. I mean, I had half-hour education a day of Cymraeg from the age of about four or five, you know, so I was of that generation. So yeah, it's a hugely different landscape to even a few short years before. But yeah, you were saying that it's based on punk, and you've got bands like Dat Pluggy and Revan, Fat Coffee Pow, which is Griff Rees's band, and Akiv, which is Mark Roberts and Paul Jones from Catsonia. And they would kind of swap members, so to speak, wouldn't they, go into their sort of 90s guises. But very much the boom period of Welsh music is based, there's got a lot to thank that Welsh language scene that was bubbling away under the surface in the mid-80s.
And growing up in the 90s, I certainly had no knowledge of this whatsoever, as a person was, of how much it was down to that, to the bands that were just getting, if they were lucky, a Peel session, a John Peel session in 1986, and how much that fed into them, what happened next. Something I only found out about many years later. Were you going to try and miss something as well, Bill?
Well, I was just saying, a lot of the labels were really important as well, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Angst, obviously, being a big one.
Mm.
Compilation I found of Radio Cymru sessions from 88 to 98. Just some of the brilliant bands on there.
Yeah,
you know, Dat Pluggy you talked about. And then Rhys Moon, you mentioned Unreven, his band Unreven, but he also had a label, didn't he, as well?
Yeah.
But it was a very influential compilation. Maybe you could pronounce it, because my Welsh is there.
But that's as well where I thought he was such an ideal choice for the foreword of the book. I'd love to have got someone like Nicky Wire or someone like that. But I think in terms of an historical perspective, he's perfect for it. In terms of, so Rhys Moyne, he's a Radio Cymru host now. Back then he was a fiery punk, you know, he's such a sort of mellow character now in comparison, you know, lovely guy. But he moved the goalposts in terms of in the 80s, he was going armed with these two compilations of Welsh language music. So there's Camer Tawolowch and Gadael I Goenfed Ganrif, I think that's, may have pronounced that just about right. But yeah, he was going around London and seeing the whites of people's eyes. So he was going and, you know, seeing John Peel. He was going and seeing John Robb at Sounds. He was going to see David Quantick at Enemy. All in one day as well.
This was the days when you could just, and I think you mentioned it.
Yes.
You could just walk in to the NME or whoever. You just walk in and go, where's Stephen Wells?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, he's over there.
Yeah.
You don't want to talk to him though, he's weird. you could just do that. And those days seem a while ago.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
A print media seems a while ago.
Dilemma for Merthyr as well. Which was more of a, like you say in the book, there's not like a Welshness to it, is there? Because the more English language Welsh bands. And also, it was put together.
Yeah.
But it's a very important release because it sort of had that crossover, didn't it? Had a lot of the bands, like obviously Mannix, Catatonia, Gorky's, and also, but like lesser known ones like Helen Love, Melis, Dub War, Dorero, was kind of
bad. And what's great with that compilation as well is that it starts off with a song called Welsh Bands.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
And nobody is like, you know, missing the irony in that. You know, that's how, by 1997 when this is released, you know, like only a few years before, people would take that entirely at face value as well.
Yeah, and Simon Williams from Fierce Panda,
that's it,
he put it together, didn't he?
Yeah,
which I didn't realise until I read the book, which was interesting.
Ah, right,
well, I know it's Fierce Panda, so obviously it was him, but I didn't put that two and two, so
yeah.
He was around that one.
We mentioned a little bit about the Welsh language, which is very important in this story. And within that era, there was often a debate about, within Wales, about sort of which language bands would sing in, or should sing in, even, perhaps you could say. And then a rejection by some of what could be considered as a more sort of insular, old-fashioned Welsh, for something. He used the word internationalist for years.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that period?
Yeah, so it's quite funny in terms of like the different views on sort of nationalism and flag waving as well. So the Super Furry Animals were always very fiercely internationalist. So they would do, they would go to gigs at Club of Bar just on the road, and when the national anthem was played at the end, they would make a point of sitting down. You know, they had no sort of stop with any of that sort of flag waving. But it's quite interesting in terms of the Mannix went like kind of full circle, really, in terms of like they went from their early days of being, you know, Wales is shit and, you know, Blackwood, if it was a museum, would be full of rubble and shit, and you know, a lot of it is the, like that kind of abandonment of youth and wanting to escape your roots. You know, you see that with a hell of a lot of bands. It's all in their early years about escaping where they're from, and then they, it's kind of, certainly with the Manics, what you see now is that heroic, you know, with them coming back to their roots and embracing it. Right, I think if the Manics had come out draped in the Welsh Dragon in 1992, they would be laughed out of town even more than, you know, Welsh fans were, you know, and also as well, you know, they were pretty bold, you know, there wasn't many androgynous sort of bands around at the time, you know, I know the Swedes were around roughly the same time, but it took some, like, bold, really, on, you know, on their part to really, like, walk it like they talked it as well. But yeah, what you see with the Manics then is what kind of interested is, by 1996, when they secured that critical and commercial acclaim, they were able to embrace their Welshness then, and you've seen ever since, there's been a Welsh Dragon on Nicky Wire's bass, you know, which has stayed there ever since.
You have a lot of Welsh support bands as well.
Yeah,
up to Advoice now.
As the scene sort of developed, and I think sort of within into the mid-90s, and they were quite then supportive then, they found a bit of, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of comradeship, if you like, in that raft of Welsh bands, and would often take them on tour and so on, and that has continued.
I think Nicky Wire was one of the big supporters of Super Fairy as well.
Oh, God, yeah, I love them, yeah. They've certainly taken the Catatonia Stereophonics on the road. I'm not sure if either have ever supported, maybe. Yeah, actually, they did.
Yeah, Manic Millennium, yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of the bands that they have given that. But it's quite funny in terms of, like, again, like a 360, is that Richie Edwards famously, well, infamously, I suppose, said about the Welsh language being dead culture, and like he slacked off the alarm for bringing out sort of bilingual albums and that sort of thing.
Ironically, Richie was also famous for saying, rock and roll is dead, but it's our only culture. Yeah. So you could argue that... You can argue that one either way, depending on what subject he was talking about, but that was Ricky Edwards.
Yeah, I mean...
A lot of it was about getting attention, though, wasn't it? Because this is the era before Twitter. I mean, yeah. Richie Edwards would be cancelled. He'd be cancelled 25 times by now. But, you know, when they initially came out, they had a lot of brickbats, and there was a lot of different quotes. A lot of the UK weeklies, sort of things like the Newport Dolls, Guns and Daffodils, you know, this is Spinal Tap. You know, what was the one you were talking about as well, Gordon?
A slight language alert. You sexy mother.
Oh, that's my favourite.
Something like that. There were quite a lot, weren't there? But I think Hugh Williams from the Poosticks talked about, because he was quite an influential figure as well. We can go into that later. But I mean, and they were quite an early band, weren't they? An indie band. But he said bands can come out of Wales now and it's accepted, but it was different 30 years ago. The Manics took a lot of crap when they first came out, but with the Poosticks we never pretend we weren't Welsh, but it was quite telling. We didn't really do a lot of gigs in Wales at the time. We had to go to London and America to do our stuff, which is quite interesting, isn't it? And then obviously he came back, they went, like you said, full circle, because he ended up managing 60 Foot Dolls. He was involved with Catatonia as well. You're also part of the Welsh Music Foundation.
Yeah,
you know, whatever you think of that, but that was set up. But it did bring a lot of things to Cardiff in terms of Barfly, Radio 1, all sorts of different things, a lot of funding as well. So, you know, another key figure there, you know, could go into that more. But
exactly. We should probably bring things on to talking about the period when it really started to peak, sort of around the kind of 1996 to 1997. Welsh brands by this point were really making headway. Catatonia have already had an album out, the Manics broke through their fourth record. I think you reminded me that Fuzzy Logic by Super Fairy and Everything Still came out on the same day.
Wow. Yeah, and also Word Gets Around and Radiator were out the same day the following year.
So it's amazing how many things were coming out, not just at the same time generally, but it was exactly the same day. Records that are still being listened to.
What about the Darling Buds and Madonna?
Yes, so
Erotica, the album.
Yeah, the Darling Buds.
That was a good story.
Famously released an album called Erotica, and then about a week later Madonna released an album called Erotica, but they've actually got similar artworks as well.
And it's bad luck, isn't it?
They're one of those bands that span sort of like the indie pop thing, going, because they were at C87, weren't they, and then they went into like the shoegaze thing, and then tail end of the, you know, Cool Cymru.
Yeah. And the thing is as well, like, you know, they weren't just like, as I say, they were touring America around this time, Madonna, but like, you know, you're going up against the biggest artist on the planet, you know, so it was completely sort of dwarfed in terms of success and that. But another kind of band that's kind of uncelebrated, really, I think, even now.
Definitely.
It's a shame when you see them putting on such kind of small gigs now, because you think, you know, they've got some great tunes,
And they signed a 4AD at one point?
Sorry?
When they signed a 4AD at one point?
Yeah, I think they were, so we were talking about 96, was it?
Yeah, exactly. And how a lot of the Welsh bands were sort of swept up in the Britpop period, which by this point had probably already sort of reached critical mass and was perhaps just starting to creep and come down the other side. But some of the Welsh bands at the time were perhaps hitting some quite different beats to the sort of Oasis mob and their imitators, like Super Furies. Gorky's were never quite the same thing. Gorky's always a funkier kind of outfit anyway.
So yeah, you talk about coincidences in like anniversaries. So the Holy Bible was released on the same day as Deathly Maybe. So there's an unlikely comparison piece.
Whole chapter on that.
So you've got songs like, you know, Dixie's Dinner about lasagna, and then you've got like A Walking Abortion on the Maddox album and Die in the Summertime.
I did think that was good comp, you know, like contrast.
I thought it was quite, I did enjoy writing that little comparison. But so if you think of the Super Furies, Alan McGee at Creation Records saw them at only their second ever gig outside Wales. And there's the urban legend that says that Alan McGee approaches them after the gig and says, "I'll give you a contract if you sing in English." And Griff Rees at his fix of Bethesda Tone says, "We were singing in English." He signed them on the basis that he thought they were going to be like Blur. And I suppose if you think of them in their cagoules and combats, they look like any other Britpop band, but they, you know, they're completely different in terms of like what the band is like driving into the Irish Edmonds in a tank and stuff like that, you know.
Or playing an instrumental and asking everyone to sing along in whatever
language. Absolutely. If you think from 1996 onwards, so you've got Everything Must Go, that's my controversial Mannix opinion, is that I actually prefer Everything Must Go to The Holy Bible. I love both, but
it's an acceptable opinion.
Two different sides of the band, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's brilliant, The Holy Bible, but...
Well, I think a lot of people got into the Mannix through Everything Must Go, and they went back and bought all the albums and everything.
Yeah. Well, and like, the timing of that single, A Design for Life, you know, they've been through such heartache with the disappearance of Richie Edwards, but to come back with that single at that moment just completely transformed their career. I think they, you know, it's got four top 10 singles on the album, only just missed out on number one by George Michael, I think, older. And yeah, the thing that's criminal as well is the fact that A Design for Life lost out to Return of the Mac. So there's that. So there was that huge success. I think it, you know, topped a lot of the polls with Enemy and Melody Maker for their, you know, when Brit Awards. You've got the Furries emerging with Fuzzy Logic exactly the same day. You've got the emergence of Catatonia with Way Beyond Blue in 1996, and the 60-Foot Dolls released only a week later after the Everything Was Going.
I've got a question for you, putting you on the spot. I saw an article yesterday about what was the first Britpop song. What was the first Cool Cymru song?
Oh, jeez, my God.
Because I didn't know. I wasn't sure on that one.
Unless we want to go too far, something like Way Beyond Blue, probably, perhaps, if you stylistically.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Because you couldn't really say You Love Us or...
Yeah.
Or Motorcycle Emptiness.
Yeah, because I suppose Cool Cymru is roughly about 1996 to about 2000, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Roughly.
If you believe it exists,
about 98, 99, I'd say. But then they always say with movements, you have... It kind of starts 2 years before the movements actually started. So if you think
you have
like Gorky's, Bible and stuff
Gorky's
like
that, as well, yeah, you know, Gorky's with their first album, 94.
Yeah, so... Interesting, yeah.
Have a think about it.
We're talking a little bit about that, because we were still in the days of, no one talks about this now, but it's still very much a time of indie versus selling out to the majors. We're having bands who had previously been or would have been only a cult concern, you know, a John Peel session or two on late 11 o'clock on Radio 1, and they were now selling millions. So there was still a debate over selling out and did it matter, was it important? We talked a little bit about Mellis, didn't we? When they had an incident backstage as guests of, but when the Super Furies were playing gigs with Blur.
Yeah, so that kind of... it's indicative of how like Britpop had run out of control. So I did one of these talks with Mellis up in North Wales and shit, this story, I'd never heard it before. And they were saying that, they went backstage as guests of the Super Furies who were supporting Blur. And moments before Blur were due to go on stage, Damon's having like a panic attack and they, you know, said to him, what's the matter? And he said, I've got to find my watch. And they're like, you know, you'll be fine, don't worry about your watch. And it turned out that he was being sponsored to wear this watch. And it was quite a hefty sum involved to wear this watch and have it like publicly seen and be in photos and videos and that sort of thing. But he couldn't find this watch anywhere. But yeah, it is indicative of that, you know, even when the Manics came out, really, like, there was still that real indie sort of centric sort of feeling in the country, like, in terms of, like, you know, you don't sell out. But yeah, you've got bands like the Manics saying they're going to outsell Appetite for Destruction and do, like, a fortnight of Wednesday.
16 million albums.
Exactly, yeah.
But they had more of a, like, they going back to what you talked about before, they at the time they saw the... whilst seen as a bit more insular,
yeah,
and they were thinking more like international.
Yes,
but in that early 90s, like you were talking about there, it's like sort of the independent scene at the time, it was seen as like you were a sellout if you went,
yeah,
you went on a major label, if you wanted a hit, all of those things were, you know.
Yeah. So if you think, like, ever since Oasis have, you know, I like Oasis, I'll throw it out there, not really, you know, what's the word, slag them off or anything, but they changed the landscape in terms of, like, it's been referred to that sound of music as indie music ever since, but it's not at all, you know, it's that they were having hugely, you know, like, how many records is what's going on in Glory, about 20 million worldwide, you know, it's not indie in any respect, you know, so yeah, they it's that shift, you know, if you think of it as a cool company, it's Britpop as well, in terms of selling in huge numbers. So by 1998, you've got the Manics selling 5 million copies of This My Truth, Tell Me Yours.
There's 3 million people in Wales.
And yeah, 1 million was from Wales. So 1 in 3 people in Wales had a copy of This My Truth, Tell Me Yours.
I love that.
And when they reached the number one in 2021 with Ultra Vivid Lament, When they released This Is My Truth, it was 130,000 first week sales to get to number one. When they got to number one in 2021, it was 27,000 copies they sold to get to number one. So it's a hugely different world now. Streaming has come massively.
We've talked about where the industry is. Yeah.
Going back to Blur, I went to see, what venue was that?
I think it was at London Arena or something.
Yeah, I went to that tour. Wow. But I actually went for the Super Furies because I was so into the Super Furies at the time. But I love Fuzzy Logic because, like, I remember looking in the inlay and it was like they were standing outside a Brains Bridge.
Yes,
like,
that's a classic.
And I was like, oh, that's in Canton, that is. That's around the corner. So they have that kind of relatable quality to them, as well as some of the subject matter, which was just bonkers, like, you know, UFOs and Howard Marks and all that.
I think Griff is the real sort of genius of the era, really.
Yeah.
When you think of...
Eros as well.
Sorry?
Eros.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Eros was a prodigious sort of talent, wasn't he? Were they about 14, 15 when they started?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But if you think of Griff in terms of, he's gone into sort of film soundtracks, he's gone to books, he did the Candyline play, wasn't it, over in Swedish Stadium?
Yeah.
He's tried on so many different hats now, and he's got this, like, solo career that is prolific and yet doesn't lose any of its quality control. And he's so sort of accessible across the city. Like, you'll see him just walking around Cardiff and he's relatively unbothered, you know, like, by people.
I got once bumped out of a conversation outside Chapel because Griffiths turned up and he was more important. I'm not better.
Yeah, you used to see him, like, cycling into town in the 90s. Like, I'd be going to like college or something, yeah, and cycling
he's
to
such,
town.
He's such a supporter of grassroots music as well. Yeah, you know, like he's very often in Club of Obark. He plays in sort of grassroots venues across Wales. He usually has an up and coming Welsh artist on the bill as well.
He'll do interviews where he talks about his favourite falafel restaurants in Cambridge Road.
Exactly, yeah. So he's never lost his roots.
Don't get that with Damon Albarn.
No,
but he's never stopped evolving, has he?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think he's like 25 albums into his career now.
What I like about him is he always does what's inspiring him at that moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
We talked quite a bit about super theories and coming towards the latter part of the decade. When we were discussing it beforehand, we're talking about despite all the big gigs at that point, Catatonia at Margam, Stereophonics at Moorfoot Stadium in Swansea, which I was at,
Manic Millennium.
At the end of. But in terms of creatively, you're saying, is it possibly an argument that the album Mung by the Super Furies was one of the crowning glories of that period's creative?
Could even be the crowning glory, I think, in terms of Manic Millennium was such an incredible end to the whole era, not just the decade, but the millennium, you know. Wales coming of age, effectively, that night, really, and with an amazing Welsh bill as well. I know people will say, you know, perhaps Manic had actually had better gigs and performances than that. I know that gig was kind of like a guinea pig project with the first one, wasn't it?
There's so many people there, and you couldn't even get to the bars.
Exactly, so. Yeah. So I know there was a lot of people over there.
Big puddles as well.
But like when you think of in 1989, the Manics played Radcliffe Square Club across the road.
Yeah.
The two people, and they weren't even paying punters. It was Richie's sister and their manager. And
you could go back to the busking days as well, couldn't you, really?
Exactly, yeah. You know, that is a hell of a story to go from that to headlining the Millennium.
And Kerris Matthews, another busker as well.
Exactly, yeah. You know, but I think with Mung, it's that fact of you had those bands in the 80s who, like For Coffee, Power, and a Kiv, who were getting frustrated with performing at the same Welsh festivals to the same audiences. And that inertia of where do we go from here, you know, they had a bigger ambition than Rhys Moyne's era. So Rhys Moyne's ambition that Plugi and Revan era was to get a Peel session. The following generation was to get on Top of the Pops, the Greatest Magazine covers, which is, you know, what you saw in the 90s. But yeah, like for them to take that decision to go into the English language and have quite a lot of flack for it, to then get that level of critical and commercial acclaim, but then go all the way back to the start and release an album in their mother tongue, overseas as well, you know, across the UK.
Very influential as well.
Big selling as well.
A quote from Gwenno, to do with the point when they were so popular, was a turning point. It gave people a touchstone. It's not just another Super Furries record, it's amazing. You talk to people about the Welsh language music, and it's not a genre. It's the easiest way to sing, and they didn't think twice about it.
So yeah.
They almost stripped it all back as well, didn't they, musically?
I mean,
the chapter.
That's such a bold move in itself.
It is.
They had this real sort of like madcap pop template, guitar pop template for the first three albums that they could have jettisoned all that support doing this like stark stripped back album, kind of focused on.
And Creation didn't want to release a lot of their.
And they had to self-release it as well because Creation had gone under. But yeah, like completely pulled her off with aplomb, and they normalised bands singing in their mother tongue. So like Ad Wife now sing because it's absolutely natural to them to sing in their mother tongue. It may even have created like a culture now where, you know, it's not particularly lucrative for any sort of new artist now, unfortunately, but in very sort of loose speech marks, it could be more lucrative for Welsh language artists in Wales now than English language, because you get to headline festivals across Wales, whereas
internationally as well, possibly.
Exactly, yeah, across Europe and that sort of thing.
Griff from Libertino Records said that artists who were born in the late 90s, early 2000s, they're far more world consumers of music.
Yeah.
And they've got that sort of confidence that maybe we were talking about early 90s, you know, or, you know, there was that kind of glass ceiling, wasn't there, for Welsh? I mean, there still is in a lot of respects, but there's that kind of inner confidence that we're going to do it anyway. We're going to, you know, export our culture or, you know, get people to buy into it. And you have artists like Ad Wife, like you said, Sage Todd's, a lot of, I mean, even you know, going back to my time getting into music, like Gorky's was definitely a big influence in terms of just like hearing Welsh and like singing Welsh and learning Welsh, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that changes then as people from Wales, particularly from the perhaps the more anglicised end of the country, yeah. Southeast Wales.
I mean, that's I didn't even get taught Welsh at school, so.
In subtle ways, that starts to, I think, affect the little germs of something that maybe changes how you feel.
Yeah.
How you feel about your place within the country, within the culture, and that's incredibly important.
Yeah, and I think often it's more complicated than people realise. It's not one thing or the other, but I mean, it's good that people have that kind of confidence now, isn't it? And I think there's more interest in it, especially overseas than in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, because Griff was also telling me that Adwy sell out tours in Europe, so
yeah,
there's that interest, isn't there, that maybe like 30 years ago, before Mung, before Catatonia, it wouldn't have happened, you know? So there is that permission that the Cool Cymru bands gave.
I was speaking to Griff from Liberty last week, actually, and he was saying that, well, this is a whole different conversation.
It's got some interesting ideas.
Was Cool Cymru, did it hamstring Wales in any ways in terms of, like, ever since, like, bands are expected to sound exactly like those Cool Cymru bands?
Yeah, and he also said that, you know, do we necessarily have to have permission for people outside to be cool? That a lot of those bands were cool already. Yeah. Like Super Furry Animals were cool, Gorky's were cool, Mannix were cool. But on the flip side, in that era, to get like the Weekly or the John Peel session, that was important, wasn't it?
But so, like Griff was saying, you know, he's someone who's running a record label in Libertino, and he's saying, unfortunately, you do need that London access, you know,
it's a huge
obstacle in your way.
One thing that's never changed.
But, like, it's odd in terms of, so, although this was huge and got so many, like, you know, got rave reviews across the board, only a few short years later, so if you watch the, do you know there was that Tsunami concert in the stadium, there was the 20th anniversary documentary recently, and there was quotes in that saying that this is only 5 years removed from Cool Cymru, so we should relatively be still the in thing. But they felt that apathy again, that, like, it wasn't happening at Wembley Stadium, hence the press wasn't that interested in it.
Yeah.
But it was the biggest charity concert since Live Aid. So it should have been this huge deal, you know.
And due to that concert, which I was at, I can go to my grave saying that I've seen Jules Holland and Boogie and the woman from M People.
You sound really excited.
And Eric Clapton just completely bemused this gold looking chain dance around him.
Standing there looking very old.
But even at the Manic Millennium, I remember everyone singing along to Delilah, so, you know, that was a bit cringeworthy then. So
we've been talking a little bit about this idea of what could be strands, if you like, of the sort of legacy of this tour. Mm. And that idea of, like, the change in perception from the outside, maybe, of Welsh art and what art and music from Wales can be, and also the shift in confidence internally for Welsh artists and what they feel they're able to do. What other elements do you think are part of that kind of legacy, if you like, of that period?
Well, the festivals you've got now, Focus Wales,
yes,
every year in Wrexham is an excellent festival. 300 artists every year, like, you know, a lot of the best Welsh artists and international artists from Sweden and Japan, and you've got Green Man every year, which is an excellent Taffel and the Castle, which is a Welsh language thing. You couldn't have envisaged that like 30 years ago, could you? Or, you know, in the early 90s, possibly.
Yeah.
A lot of these things are like, but often I think, you know, going back to Griff again, it's like he talks about like building community ourselves and then taking it to other people rather than waiting for, you know, a London label to come and sign you up, and because these days it takes so long to break a band,
even if you can,
you know, it takes years and years, and because of the algorithm and the social media age we live in, all of these things, like reading that book, it's like it's a different world, isn't it, almost?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, because those days you could go on Top of the Pops and you'd be your record sales would go up, go on John Peel's Evening Session.
Well,
you know,
it's the last sort of period before the internet boomed as well. Yeah. So like, I know, like, Noel Gallagher has said a lot about Nedworth being the last sort of mass gathering of people before, like, mobile phones became ubiquitous and the internet boomed. So if you think, like, of all these gigs here, none of them were seen through the lens of, like, mobile phone. So yeah, it's a completely different world. I know Rhys Boyne asks in the intro why Cork Henry never happened. I mean, thank God it did, really, in terms of, like, it is an amazing era to look back and celebrate. It's inspired, I think it still does inspire, I would say Super Furies are the most influential on grassroots bands across Wales.
I got a good quote from Carl Bevan before he died.
Oh, right.
10 years ago. Prior to Cork Henry, Welsh music was generally ridiculed by the London-based industry and had no chance of being taken seriously. It's great to think that the president now is permanently in the opposite way. I mean, that was 10 years ago, but yeah. I mean, it is a positive. Yeah. I mean, he was one of the people involved in it, so, you know.
I do wonder whether, though, because of streaming, you know, it's massively changed how much fans have got, obviously, with, you know, the money involved is disgraceful, really. But I do think with the streaming, it has perhaps created that healthy culture of, like, a DIY culture. And that's sort of going back full circle again to the 80s in Wales, where it was very much like on a punk ethos of DIY and handies and all that.
That's the thing about genres, in a way. They've kind of changed, like, I was talking to somebody about, like, what chill out means now. It's more of a playlist, isn't it?
Mm.
And maybe Welsh music, you know. But there's all different strands to Welsh music, isn't there? There's labels that, you know, like Libertine or like Bubble Wrap, Repeat Records. Mm. There's loads of good labels in Wales still.
And the second thing is with streaming is that I know the Poopsticks and Swansea Sound articulate this very well in their songs, you know. I think one of the chorus goes ... 1 of a penny or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, Welsh band Himalayas have had like 25 million streams for one song.
And it was other band Alpha, what they call it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But in terms of remuneration, in terms of that, what it actually means, probably not a lot, you know.
That is the thing about streaming, isn't it? It compared to physical. That's why when you go to a gig, always try and buy some merch or a record or something, like, you know.
Any of those bands back then, to know anything about them, you had to buy the records or the weeklies, you know. Whereas now, a click of a button, it's taken all the mystique of a band away.
It's totally different.
But
there's also the fact that you don't have to rummage around on your hands and knees in a record shop as well. You can just, like, type anything into YouTube or whatever.
We have all done that at some point.
You all have done.
But I think we should pause for it and see if we have any questions, if that's okay.
Cool.
Anyone have any questions for the music girl?
Hello.
Hello.
How do you think, if at all, Cork Henry relates to the world reputation of the land of song? You know, you showed it back to Harry Seacombs, you know, the Tom Jones. Like, does it, is it the same or is it not?
The answer.
It's quite funny in terms of, I always think that, like, with media slogans like Cork Henry, land of song to an extent, it always gets pushbacks from creative people. So There's a section in the book about there was actually pushback against the moniker of Land of Song when it was first coined, because it was bestowed on the Welsh by the Victorians. With Cork Henry, it was kind of like, I think it was first coined in the Western Mail, but then the London Press.
The Welsh government part of it as well? It
was
Hugh Williams talks about it was part of a Welsh government sort of PR thing.
Yeah.
Almost.
And I think the fact that it's alliterative, you know, headlines and, you know,
it's a bit like Britpop in a way. It's not really, it's a very ill-fitting sort of term, isn't it, for a lot of different artists, you know, and even some of the smaller ones you talk about in the book just don't fit into that.
No, not at all. Right, so go back to your question. So what was it, how does the Land of Song and Cork Henry call it?
Do they relate, or are they just separate from it?
So the Land of Song, I would say, harks all the way back to the first traditions of Welsh music, which is like choral music.
Folk music.
Yeah, and chapel. And so you had a lot more of a religious society going back, you know, in the sort of 1800s. So that would be, you know, whole families and communities would go to the chapel, and that would be their communal experience of singing. Then, you know, sort of fast forward to the 60s and beyond, you've got four hugely popular artists, so that's Tom Jones, Shirley Bassey, and a bit later on, Shakin' Stevens, who was the biggest selling UK artist of the 80s, full stop.
Yeah. Did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. And so we didn't get a number one single in Wales between Merry Christmas Everyone in 1985 and If You Tolerate This in 1988. And another little factoid for you, Merry Christmas Everyone by Shakin' Stevens was actually held back a year, so it wouldn't clash with Band Aid.
Bit like Last Christmas as well.
Yeah. So they pushed it back here and they both had number one there. I'm digressing here. Right. Yes, so on top of that, you've got Bonnie Tyler as well, who was hugely successful in the States as well.
Shirley Bassey.
And Shirley Bassey, yeah. So, but I think it kind of fed into that culture amongst sort of alternative music fans, and certainly with the alternative music press, of it's good and it's good, it's commercial selling music, but it's not to be taken seriously. Do you know what I mean? And I suppose around that same time, you didn't have many English language bands who were really making waves. I suppose the Alarm had transatlantic success.
Yeah.
But apart from that, you've got maybe Skritti Palitti were very indie. You've got Young Marble Giants very indie again. So it did take that sort of influx of bands with real ambition, all coincided within a year or two of each other to... You know, if you think, like, the timing of the Manics coming through in 1992, and then Catatonia and Gorky's just on their backs very shortly later, it is incredible timing, really. And then you've got, you know, Stereophonics. It's quite funny, like, in terms of, like, I never knew people really hated Stereophonics, you know, but until I started doing the podcast, and then all the comments, like,
I remember.
And it was one of the funniest comments I saw on the on one of the posts was... Can you release this book, but an edited version that doesn't mention Stereophonics?
You know, the Big Noise Festival down the bay, that was the first contact I had with a lot of these bands, because it was 97, I think they were all supporting Paul Weller. So
yeah,
you had 60 Foot Dolls, Catatonia, Gene. I mean,
if you listen to that Stereophonics set on YouTube, it's so cool.
And then
really
Stereophonics, that was the first time I'd ever
seen. It's a lot rawer.
It's the first time I'd ever seen a Stereophonics.
Yeah, yeah.
But to be honest, I thought Catatonia and 60 Foot Dolls were much better, to be honest, at the time.
Yeah.
It shows how much I know, but I mean, obviously, Catatonia were really...
That's a debate you can keep having forever,
but then,
I think.
Kelly Jones, I mean, I didn't really know who he was, but he was swanning around in, like, a sheepskin rock star coat then, and they hadn't even done a record out.
Sheepskin coat? I'd forgotten the sheepskin coat.
And didn't Kerris come on stage during Space... Drunk,
yes,
as well,
yeah,
with the Man United top.
Michael, yeah.
It was very memorable.
Can we just say, these are iconic moments of the era. Kelly Jones in a sheepskin coat, Kerris being drunk.
I do love Word Gets Around, though. I think that does stand on its own as a really cool album, and it was perfectly timed in terms of that shift in confidence again, in terms of putting a tiny Welsh mining village on the map. So I'd never heard of Commandment, and like there's a real unique Welshness to being ultra loyal to where you live. So they were never from Aberdeen, even though it's like 2-3 miles up the road. It's Commandment, you know.
Which reminds me of my ex-girlfriend, whose dad is from Tonnebay near Neath, and the next village up the valley is Resolven. And her dad just doesn't like people from Resolven. It's about 3 miles up the valley, people from Resolven.
A lot of the stories were local as well, weren't they?
Oh yeah, so I worked on the local paper up there about 10 years later. And the people in the song were still walking on the town. So the teacher who was caught up in the scandal in A Thousand Trees had been released from prison by this point. And half the community believed him and half didn't. You know, it split the sort of community in half in terms of, like, he would go into a pub and he would be welcomed, like, maybe on one half of the pub, you know, and that sort of thing. But yeah, like, if you think of, like, those songs came from, like, just like a bedroom on a terrace street in the valleys, it's pretty inspirational for, like, young kids, you know. And, like, with that, so, like, you've got them putting, you know, and it always makes me think of, like, Wales away games where, like, you'll have a Wales flag in the crowd and it's the tiniest, like, town or village across this flag, you know. But yeah, with that, you get, like, real sort of, like, these self-referential nods to, like, a growing sense of pride in Welshness. So you've got, as we said earlier, Dylan for Murphy, you've got Barra Fundle, Gorky's making an album after their favourite birth, the local beach. You've got Donna Lewis, who was huge with I Love Yours Forever. Album now in a Minute, you know, a real Welsh club that is in there, you know.
I didn't even know when she had that one hit, I didn't even know she was Welsh.
And what kept her off number one in the States?
Go on, tell me.
Hang on. The Macarena.
Again, iconic moments of the 1990s of Don Macarena. We've got a good tangent, but...
A question just occurred to me, because like, reading the title again, because you talk about the charts a lot, and you're like proper really good on that. It's like ChatGTP written, you know, like all the stats and everything on charts. But like, did you consider doing it maybe a different way? Because obviously there's a lot about success and stuff. But success doesn't always like translate to quality, does it?
Yeah.
Well, I understand because of that period, it was a.
And also, I thought it was key to write about the 90s as a decade, not just the Cool Cymru years, because the interesting stuff is the story that led up to it. But the charts meant so much more back then as well. Yeah. You know, if you consider like some of the gems, like these bands had on B sides. You know, there was something really. Special about singles at the time because unless you bought the CD, you wouldn't have access to these B-sides. You click the button now, wouldn't it? But I think it's that sort of last era where the charts meant something. I think, could anyone tell us what's number one now?
No.
See what I mean?
Yeah, you are right. No, I just wonder because you know there's different ways of approaching it, isn't there? But I understand in the 90s it was an anomaly in a way for Welsh music.
And it's not to say that everything is successful is good.
That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah,
yeah. You know, there's real merit in stuff like the Hoopsticks, who would never get anywhere near the charts. Like Patio Song stalled at number 41. That was the closest they ever got to breaking.
And like you mentioned, Young Marble Giants, probably a very influential band on.
What were they on? Were they a rough
local
trade?
Scene,
yeah, exactly,
local scene
yeah.
for decades to go.
But would probably, you know, if you went out into town now and said if you heard Marble Giants, maybe one or
you
two.
You might
people,
be surprised. You never know. One of them might be out there, actually, isn't it? The Strand. Actually, we've gone on a tangent. But good
sorry.
Do you have any other questions at all?
I came to Cardiff in 1970. And there is a band that I saw in Cardiff Chapel that you haven't mentioned to me, and I think they've been extremely influential. That's Man.
Yes, yeah.
Could you talk about Man?
Ooh. So that's Deke Leonard, isn't it?
I sense that nothing happened before the 1990s, and that is not true.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to see Sagan Stevens in the Students' Union, and it was huge.
The first few chapters of the book are very much 70s, 80s, 60s.
Yeah, so the intro covers... basically from the Chapel origins all the way through to the 60s, 70s. So yeah, there is a bit of Man in there.
Bad Finger,
this is what I'm saying, like in terms of, in the intro of the book, I actually go in to say that it was entirely unfair that Wales had this reputation within Laughing Stock, because they always had these touchstones of great music, like Man, like Budgie, like John Cale. One of the most influential musicians ever, really, John, in the Velvet Underground as well. But Badfinger as well. I think sold 15 million records worldwide. Yeah. A Welsh sort of Beatles of sorts, mentored by Paul McCartney.
Signed to Apple at one point.
Won like Ivan Novello for Without You, which was famously covered by Mariah Carey, went on to be a worldwide hit. And one of the most tragic stories in rock and roll is Badfinger. So yeah, I did think it was really important to mention these bands like Man and like these sort of maverick sort of characters like Deke Leonard, and giving them like this sort of acknowledgement and the, you know, the inspiration they gave to the later bands. Unfortunately, with the sort of restraints of the book, really, I couldn't go into like big detail on them. But yeah, they're certainly in the early chapters of the book. Yeah. Stuff about Man and that sort of thing, yeah.
Which leads us on to maybe sort of last question, really. You know, this book stops largely around the end of the century. Planning a sequel, planning another book, or are you hoping to never reference another article?
The afterword goes into some of it.
Yeah. So I've had a nice rest for a year now anyway, so that's been quite nice.
Apart from the 21 events.
Well, 21 events, yeah. So where the intro covers roughly the 60s to the end of the 80s, the outro covers the 21st century. Obviously, it's skimmed over quite a bit because it's obviously an outro. But the most commonly asked question I have in all these talks is, what happened after Cool Cymru? You know, did Wales suddenly stop becoming cool again? And I have thought about doing a follow-up for the 21st century, because you've got loads of stuff that you can reference. Like, you've got that whole Bridgend scene, you've got Newport Revisited with bands like Golden Looking Chain and Skindred. You've got acts like Duffy, you chart-topping success. You've got like some really great female artists like Kate Le Bon, the Anchoress,
Gweno.
Glass Gweno, yeah. You know, Gweno now immortalised with the mural on Club of Back, just across town.
Nose does not look right on that mural.
Does it not? All right, so, it's just a little bit off orientation. So yeah, I contemplate him, but at the moment with working and.
It's so much more fragmented, isn't it? Because we talked about streaming.
Yeah,
before.
I mean, this in a nutshell is such an amazing story. There's a real arc to it.
Yeah, and if you watch the creation documentary, I mean, you talked about selling out before. That kind of tells the story almost of indie independent labels, you know, and to the end of the Britpop era sort of thing, and the sort of how they got sold, you know, bought out by a lot of the majors, and how it's sort of the music sort of got watered down almost a little bit.
A lot to cover as it's covered in this book. Like I mentioned briefly, referenced in the article. If you were to have a look at the end
of references.
I can't really do the pages very well from here, but they just keep going. So if you have any
So
exhaustively.
There's a story behind the endnotes. The publishers Calon, who were a dream to work with, said all the way through that it's enough to say Nicky Wire said in Enemy in February 1998. And then in the final 2 weeks before publication, they were like, we need everything. Everything footnoted. I think there's 580 quotes in the book.
Wow.
So that was, and like, you're talking of magazines that are like 30 years old. You know, I've got no physical copies, a lot of.
And there's a hell of a lot of detail in there as well.
Yeah,
as well,
so they were at least gracious enough to say,
like Wikipedia.
You can leave page numbers off. So I was like, right, okay, that's cool. But yeah, rough sort of footnotes, yeah.
Yeah, but so there's if there ever is another sequel, I'm sure it will be exhaustively researched as this one. Right. We should probably start winding things up, I think. Really.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And so, what's it to thank everyone who's got involved this evening and come along again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We'll have some books for sale just over on the table over there in a moment. And you can also, goes without saying, borrow international value from the library. In terms of our events, we have a month off to go to our second homes in the south of France in August, or eat chips in Bally Island, whichever those point you find more believable, really, I don't care. But we'll be back in September chatting about book podcasting with crime fiction expert Paul Burke of Crime Time FM. So it's something a little bit different for us with a podcast angle, the two regular podcasters here with me. So there'll be details on that online in the next few weeks. Keep an eye on the kind of Libraries ticket source page and our social media for info on that. So thank you once again. Do check out some books. Can we say thank you once again to Bill Cummings and to Neil Collins?
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks for coming. Stay beautiful.